So, just to remind you, we're talking about the de Broglie model. We had basically the two equations are the Schrodinger equation and the guidance equation. So the velocity of the nth particle is given by this. And what I said I was going to do was study the theory of measurement, the Broglie model. Get to that. Imagine we have a system and it interacts with another system, which we take to be a classical measuring apparatus, so a pointer. So we have some quantum system, which is initially in a superposition of two different states. So psi AX and psi BX. The total wave function is just the sum of those two things with some amplitudes. And we want to also have this interact with some kind of box as a pointer on it. This is the pointer. If the pointer goes in one direction, it indicates the result A. It indicates that we have this wave packet. If it goes in the other direction, it indicates that we have the other one. So we can think that these two systems will interact. Maybe the system will just pass through here. So the initial state is that the initial state is we assume this one has position, this one has initial state 0 y. That's the 0 means that the pointer is initially pointing to the 0 in the middle. So if this apparatus has been well designed, then what we expect is that this state will go to a superposition where you have this term causing the pointer to go to the left, and this term where you have the pointer going to the right. And I'm ignoring the evolution of these wave packets during the course of the measurement. One could model this more carefully. That's the salient. We want to imagine this is true. So these two the wave functions associated with the two positions of the pointer are barely overlap. The overlap is 0. And here I mean that they don't overlap in physical space. This is a stronger statement than saying that the that they're orthogonal in Hilbert space. You know, for example, you could have the ground state and the first excited state of a well. Those will be two states like this and like this, and these two states have zero overlap in treated as Hilbert space vectors, but they do overlap in physical space. And we want the stronger condition in this Bohm measurement that they actually don't overlap in physical space. So now, I want to treat, I want to think about what happens to these trajectories during the course of this measurement. So, we have the trajectory associated with the system we're looking at, the actual trajectory, the x trajectory. And then we have trajectory associated with the pointer, y trajectory. Let me just draw some sort of instruction lines to help me draw this. Here's a square. This space, and I want to divide the square up into quadrants. And initially, what does it say? So so this is the pointer. So it has three positions that we're particularly interested in. There's the zero position here. There's the A position, and then there's the B position. Okay. So initially we have a wave packet associated with the X, the x direction, and we have the pointer in the zero position. So what we have are basically two sort of the wave path. The wave function will occupy this region and this region. Is that clear? So this initial state here will look like this if we plot it into this diagram. And the particle position will either, the two particles will either correspond to a position in here somewhere or a position in here somewhere. Now I want to evolve this in time. So let me draw another square at a later time. cube. The four quadrants again. Now if we have this wave packet here, then that's going to push the pointer into this quadrant, so we'll end up over here. And if we're in this one, we're going to push the pointer into the A position, so we'll end up in here. What we'll have is any trajectory that starts off in here will end up over here. Any trajectory that starts off in here, that's the sort of trajectory sketch. So they're sort of, this is going back, these ones are coming forward. Now let's take the pointer to be a big system. Adding some very big number of particles in the pointer. Well, that's what you expect because a pointer is a macroscopic object. It's going to have many, many particles in it. If that's the case, then we have these two pointer positions. And then we really expect, let's call this time t here. Small t. Right. We're all really expect those things once they become separated will remain. If we keep evolving this forward in time, that these two different wave packets will never overlap because there's so many particles in here doing different things. Then making them overlap would just be experimentally very difficult. If you've got a single particle inside a which goes into two different directions, then you can recombine it like so, right, with mirrors, another beam splitter, and you can make them overlap again. Perhaps overlap. But to do something like that with a macroscopic object, you'd have to reflect and then recombine that something analogous to a beam splitter, all those different particles. And then if you add in, which I haven't included in the mathematics here, the fact that the environment also interacts with this pointer, then you'd have to get all the particles in the environment also to re-overlap. So it seems, just on this sort of very basic statistical arguments, that once these particles, once these two pointers have stopped overlapping, you can't bring them back. And that's important. For this measurement model, because if you're in this this trajectory here, what it means is this wave packet over here is never going to influence this trajectory here. Let me just explain that. So we have here the guidance equation. And the guidance equation this could be the guidance equation for x or for y. Let's just take the x case. The guidance equation here is given by this expression here, where you evaluate x equals. This is a little bit confusing here because in the example we're discussing, we actually I've x used to mean all of the different positions. Now what we mean is so if we evaluate, if we calculate this property here, take the we look at the weight function, we take the derivative there, and we evaluate it at that particular position, then if you're in this wave packet, the expression you get doesn't depend on the other wave packet, because the derivatives here don't depend on what you have over here. And the values over here don't turn over here, so it's as if the velocity is given just by the expression containing psi a and psi a. So if x dot and y dot depend only on this, and furthermore, that will continue to be true into the future. So what this is saying is you have effectively derived the projection postulate of quantum theory. Because although the total wave function is still this big thing, the effective wave function is now just the one in this just the one that pertains to that. Any questions? Either there's no questions because it's very simple, or because it's. Okay.
This works only for the system with continuous variables.
Yeah, the de Broglie model is always set up. Well, okay. You can treat spin in the de Broglie model, but then you do need to have in the background, you need to also have continuous variables. What the de Broglie model doesn't do is treat systems where there's only variables.
The only operation that we have here is actually time evolution due to that, like, guidance equation, right?
Yeah, and then we also have the Schrodinger equation as well acting, but I haven't really.
Time evolution acts like a projection in this de Broglie model. We can have time evolutions that are not like projection operator.
Yeah, but this is so the wave function evolves unitarily. However, the part of the wave function that matters, as far as the trajectories are concerned, effectively projects. So you have an effective. Let's write this down properly. So the effective wave function. By effective, I mean the part of the wave function that matters for future calculations is equal to, in this example, if so if the trajectory is in the outcome corresponding to A, then this is the part of the wave function that matters. So that's the effective wave function. And that's it.
Can you repeat again, why does the other side doesn't matter? Because
the other side doesn't matter because those two, those wave packets are never going to overlap again. It doesn't matter for all practical purposes, remember this expression. Because
aren't we writing the state of the whole system, like whole configuration space, or are we writing the state of like one individual wave packet? I mean, like, what is psi effect?
Psi A is for the whole system, and this is for the pointer. So this becomes the new effective wave function for the whole system. I mean, let's imagine it this way. You could keep doing your calculations. You know, if you were actually doing these calculations, and you find the pointer is in outcome A, you could keep using the whole wave function for your calculations. Keep using the superposition. Okay. But after a certain point, you might say, well, I'm kind of feeling lazy. I don't want to have to use all of it. Can I make my life a bit easier? And it turns out you can just cross out the other term, and it won't affect your trajectories. You'll still get the same trajectories that you would have got, kept the whole thing in. And so that's what I mean by effective. So in the ontology, the whole state is still there. Both terms are still real. But if you're just interested in doing the calculation of the trajectories, you only need to keep relevant part. And that's because the particles never overlap. And when we calculate the guidance equation, we evaluate it where the particles are. And we're never going to care about what's happening in the branch. So this was David Bohm's contribution.
Is Bohmian mechanics different from this, or is it?
So yeah, there's different terms used. So the people who work on these models belong to different schools. Infighting between the different sides, and some people call it Bohmian mechanics because I'm not sure why. I guess they like the approach that Bohm took, and some people call it the De Broglie-Bohm model. I think the De Broglie-Bohm model is more accurate because really De Broglie wrote down all this stuff already in 1927, but he didn't have the measurement, didn't have treatment of measurement. And it's interesting because now you're deriving. Within this model, you're deriving the projection postulate. That's essential. Projection postulate.
What do you mean by projection postulate?
So, I mean, remember, it was on the first day when I wrote down the axioms of quantum theory, and during measurement, we said we have the projection, where you, after measurement, you use just the projected part. That's what I mean by the projection postulate. And so that projection postulate, which in those axioms looked very unnatural, because why would you treat measurement differently? In the de Broglie-Bohm model, as long as you accept the, you know, the premises, it looks very natural. You derive it. This is a strong.
But the projection was actually related to measurement. Here we don't need to even perform any measurement to.
Yeah, I mean, anything that is a measurement, you'll get this projection postulate. But it's true that you could have situations which you don't regard as measurements as such, but you have the same kind of behavior. Okay. So let me just talk a bit about non-locality in this model.
When you want to measure the trajectories, how do you measure in Bohmian like picture? Like measurement is still a projection, or like is like Newtonian? And
when you want to measure the trajectories. Yeah. So. So what you're trying to do in these interpretations is account for the way the world appears. Tables and chairs, and perceptions in our brains, and so on. We'll have more of this kind of talk when I come to the minor worlds approach. And so we want to be able to look in our theory, look in the ontology of our theory, and say, oh, look, there's the tables, there's the chairs. And in this de Broglie-Bohm model, the tables and chairs are in the particle positions. So. That's what you're trying to do. So saying that you measure them, I mean, what does a measurement mean? At some point, it's an observation in your mind, or you may say it's the world has certain classical features. That's the objective interpretation, is to at some point account for the way the world appears to us.
Because measurement is not an operation here. Like, we don't have terms like collapse of wave function anymore, because like...
Yeah. Yeah, we don't have those terms. Yeah, it's just like, what is a measurement in Newtonian? You just have particles in positions, and that's where they are. It's the same here. There is a problem in the de Broglie-Bohm model, and I'll come to that in 30 minutes. Yeah, go ahead.
Is the right way to interpret this statement that, like, macroscopically it's irreversible?
Yeah.
As... like, you have the wave functions, but then they interact with the detector, so all the particles of the detector are going, like, you have the wave function which is guiding the particles, but all the particles are really only going into one side of the wave function.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, all the particles in the detector are on that side of the wave function.
Yes. Yeah, good, thanks, yeah.
I don't care about the rest of the wave function because it's there, but it's not.
Well, no particles in it. Yeah, exactly, yeah. And it's kind of striking as all 10 to the 23 particles in the pointer end up in one part of the wave function. The other. Right. Okay. I just wanted to talk a little bit about how non-locality works in this one. I think I've said something about this already, but let me say a few more words. So the velocity in... for example, if you've got two particles in a de Broglie-Bohm model, x1 and x2, the velocity of particle 1 is a function of positions of particles 1 and 2. We know that from the guidance equation. Here I'm imagining that we have two particles with two systems, one over here and two over here. If we jiggle x2. Then the velocity of particle one changes instantaneously, depends on the position of x2. And you might ask, well, how can you jiggle something? This is a deterministic model. But you do have potentials. So you can have the total potential can be the potential acting on particle one plus the potential acting on particle two. The potential. So we can vary the potential acting on particle two in some way. Lots of ways to do that, like you introduce a potential barrier. There are lots of different things you can do. And if you vary the potential acting on particle two, then you just have to do that over here, where particle two is, by some means. And that will instantaneously affect velocity of particle. So we have non-locality. And you might say, well, why can't we use this to send information faster than light? Well, we can't, and I think I mentioned this on Wednesday. We can't. Because this effect is kind of cloaked by the statistics. So although the individual particles in this model are superluminous, are affected instantaneously, in fact, by this kind of jiggling, when you look at the statistics, there's no effect. And we know that has to be true because the de Broglie model agrees with quantum theory, and in quantum theory, everything is local.
Shouldn't this non-locality feature depend on the potential that we're using? Like we can pick a potential, fine-tune the potential in a way that like all of the non-local communications, we cannot communicate non-locally, right? Like we can pick the potential in a way that only depends on the local.
You can probably find local potentials that don't cause we want to change on. Probably find local potentials on it. Don't change. One. However, there are also many that do. So examples where you can see this.
But like it's the matter of what potential we pick, like what potential is physical.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there's lots of simple examples where you can see exactly this happening in simulations of these trajectories. So it definitely happens in the model. One kind of simulation is I think I showed you this source. You have particle one comes out here, and it either comes out on this path or this path. Particle two comes out here, either in this path or this path, and you make the state entangled. So particle one goes this way, particle two goes that way, and vice versa. If particle one goes this way, particle two goes that way. And then you bring these two together, and you put a beam splitter here. In the de Broglie model, you can model a beam splitter as a potential barrier, which is not too high. Now you have a choice over here. Either you put a beam splitter in place here, so another potential barrier, or you don't. If you put the beam splitter in here, then the particles will be affected in one way. And if you don't, they'll be affected. So this is a very simple experimental situation, and you can explicitly see the trajectories being affected by what you do here. So there's nothing unusual about it. I mean, of course, some things you do over here won't affect the trajectories, but there's very simple things you can do that do affect. Typically, any experiment like this where you expect to see a violation of Bell's inequalities, then in the Breuer model, the trajectories will be non-local. Okay. One more point here on this non-locality issue. If the if we have a wave function, imagine we have a wave function, a total wave function is a product the total wave function is a product of wave functions, the two particles. Then the velocity, particle one, is given by this. Stars. And this is the
acting on one.
So this is the partial derivative acting on x one. And so it sees phi of x two as a constant. And so that means that you can cancel. That means you can cancel this and this, and cancel this and this, and this is just equal that. So in the case where you have a product state, the velocity of the particles doesn't care about what's happening on the other side. I should have evaluated that. The other thing, the other comment which is relevant on this subject of non-locality is if you have, and I think I mentioned this for sure on Monday, but I'll mention it again, if you have a distribution rho which is not equal to psi squared, then you can explicitly see non-local effects. You'll see, you'll have signaling. And Anthony Valentini has done a lot of work on that. Let me now go through criticisms of this model. So, well, there's lots of criticisms. First, you don't actually need the guidance equation to make predictions. People have been doing quantum theory quite happily without using the guidance equation. And since we don't need it, people aren't generally going to use it. So in some ways, this is just a sort of a fact of life. If people don't need to solve some particular equation, then they're not going to. And so it's hard, really, for people to adopt this. Now, you might argue, if you want to solve the interpretational problems, then you need the guidance equation. Or you might argue, as Valentini does, that if you want to consider these non-equilibrium situations, then you definitely need the guidance equation. There's also been arguments that if you want to calculate things like tunneling times, how long a particle spends inside a barrier, or detect arrival times, then you need the guidance equation, because you need to model these trajectories. However, I think for those experiments, all the things that you might measure, all the things you might predict, can be calculated within the standard quantum framework. So you don't need guidance equation. Second, where does the guidance equation come from? I mean, there's a sort of argument you can say, well, if you have the Schrödinger equation, then you posit the existence of particles, then you can derive the guidance equation. But it seems like that's not a very deep way of thinking. Perhaps you can find some deeper principles, and then a guidance equation emerges, something which is necessary at the same time as the Schrödinger equation. It seems, to me at least, that the guidance equation is kind of a bolt-on. Schrödinger equation, then you bolt on this extra this extra equation. Third, so the first three criticisms I think are not so deep. The fourth one is more important. So here's the third. There's no back reaction of the particles on the waves. So the waves affect the particles, but the particles don't affect the waves. And many people think that if you've got two things that interact, then they should each affect each other. This idea goes back at least to Newton. And the De Broglie model doesn't have that. That's strange in some ways. And then the final criticism, I think, let's just check. This, the final criticism. It's called the many worlds in denial attack. Okay. And it's due to the comments from David Deutsch. And then a paper by Brown, Harvey Brown, and David Wallace. And so here's the argument. The wave function is something that's taken to really exist. The function is ontological, it's a real thing. And if you look at the wave function and its evolution, then it contains stories. And it contains those stories even in the empty part of the wave function.
Okay.
So over here we have this model of measurement, and if we see, if we see this outcome here, then the effective wave function becomes that. But ontologically, the real wave function, the wave function that actually exists, is still the superposition. There, you still have both terms. It hasn't actually gone away. And if you look inside that wave function, you can see all this structure of things that might happen. So for example, here's an example. Imagine if a building contractor decides if I get outcome A, I'm not going to build the building. If I get outcome B, I'm going to build the building. Okay, so and he does the experiment and he decides and he gets outcome A, so he doesn't build some big building. But In the wave function of the other part, this building will exist. All the structure inside the wave function will have this building existing. It's all in there. And the wave function is a real thing. It's not something you can ignore. There's an idea in philosophy called functionalism. And the idea, it's used especially in trying to account for sort of consciousness and so on. But the idea is if you have some process that's happening, then it doesn't matter if that process is instantiated in one kind of system, like carbon-based life form, or if it's instantiated in a different kind of system, like a silicon-based computing model. If you have the same process in those two cases, then in the example of consciousness, then if you have something that's a process in a computer which has the same functional behavior as a process in a brain, then in both cases you would have consciousness. So that's an idea of functionalism coming from philosophy. Well, here it's not about the issue of consciousness, it's about the issue of reality. In the part of the wave function that doesn't have particles in it, you still have all this stuff happening, and it's really happening. And so if you believe in functionalism, then that is real. So, and this is the many worlds argument, and this is the many worlds in denial attack. So what the people who make this attack are saying is really, you've got the wave function, it's real. There's real stuff happening in both sides. And so that's the real story. So both things definitely happen. And the particles are kind of incidental. There's some extra structure, but really, you have all this structure anyway in the wave function. The wave function is real, and so that's the attack. See if I have any more notes on that. These papers get amusing. So you see expressions like zombies and mindless hawks, because in the de Broglie Bohm model, you want to believe that if you see one outcome, then all the stuff in the other part of the wave packet, if there's people in there, then they're not really people, just zombies or mindless hulks. It does kind of touch on the issue of consciousness, actually. There's this problem that you've got all this structure, but you don't want to attribute reality to it. So in some sense, the De Broglie bell model is trying to have it both ways. It wants the wave function to be real, but it doesn't want it to be too real. And that's not really an option. You can't really say that. So I think this is a very serious problem with the De Broglie model. Now, people have countered that. So actually, Valentini in particular has arguments, which I can't. I should read his paper again. I can't recall the details there. But I think it's a problem. The way I like to see it is that this is the many worlds approach. You can imagine there's two battleships at sea. There's the many worlds battleship and there's the De Broglie bell battleship. And the many worlds battleship launches a torpedo to sink the De Broglie bell battleship successfully. And then, but then the many worlds battleship is also going to sink under the weight of its own excess ontology, as we'll talk about subsequently. That's my own image. What's happening? I'm still a big fan of the De Broglie bell model. I think it teaches us a lot and it helps us visualize, and it makes us think. It helped motivate the De Broglie. Sorry, it helped motivate John Bell, which is a big deal. It also helped motivate the PBR theorem, whereas. And the many worlds approach, I think, is interesting as well, but it's also kind of crazy. So I think what I'll do is, because the next stuff I want to talk about is the many worlds approach, and so I don't have time in the remaining 5 minutes to get much traction on that. I should warn you, so the people who've done the most interesting research, I would say, on the many worlds approach in recent years have been philosophers. And the reason for that is that is it really demands that kind of expertise. So expect to see a different style of argumentation in the next lecture than you've seen today. There aren't sort of equation, there isn't a guidance equation. It's more of a philosophical style of discussion. Okay, so are there any questions on this today?
I don't exactly see why having the complicated wave function is a problem in both models. Because, like, we're having a constant and then, like, I don't see the problem. Why wave function cannot be real in both models?
Oh, it is real. It has to be real. So it's a real thing. So I'm always worried when I use the word real, that I mean real in the ontological sense, not real in It is real. But because it's real, you now have to say, well, that's something that's really happening. So if it's really happening, then it's part of reality, and it contains complicated stories inside it. And so, why don't we just end up in the many worlds approach?
None of those other effects of wave function being real, it wouldn't be measurable unless we have some particles evolving in the potential of this wave function. So I don't see why. When we put particle in the potential of these particles, then we get all of these things that looks fine with the measure.
I think that's okay as long as you're comfortable with the assertion that the only things that we're aware of are the particles. If you make that assertion, say, well, what our experience hinges on is particle positions, then that's fine. But it's still the case, even if you believe that, there's this all this other stuff really happening that contains very complicated stories. But it's real. It's real. And it's only not measurable if you take that assertion. But why, if it is real, why wouldn't there be at least beings aware of that? Why is it something that is inaccessible? It's strange to have stuff that's real, but not accessible to us.
Field is also the same thing. Like, not all parts of the field is accessible for us, but like we say that it exists, and then we can like study the trajectories of particles.
In the case of a field, the parts that are inaccessible are we have reasons for that, like very small, or we don't happen to be there. In the case of this, the part that the other part of the wave function is contains stories just like our story,
just the same
kind of stories that we're living. There's the structure inside the wave function will correspond to people moving around. You know, if I was to flip a quantum bit right now, and we get heads, then the tails part would also still be there, and it would contain there'd still be all that story, all that stuff would still be existing in the wave function.
But it's also true about any other potential as well, not only like treating wave function as potential, like any other potential also has other stories, but everything is measurable, observable for us only when we look at the like movement of something and that potential. But like,
I mean,
potentials as emerging from like,
we don't
potential.
Yeah, exactly.
But come from like photons, like interaction of photons in like quantum theory.
Looking at some specific interaction, not all parts of the potential is accessible for you in some sense. Like, you know, like what is gravitational potential? You say that I don't know. I mean, like, it's always a. Also, I
think
like,
it's emerging from fundamental interactions of actual particles, whereas in this case,
buildings.
I mean, there's certainly people who agree with what you're saying. People who work in the model generally think of it as just being a field. It's a more complicated field than the ones we're used to.
Because it
contains all this structure, it's in configuration space. But we regard it as just
as a field.
I personally find that disturbing because there's all that structure that looks like what we.
Can we
also build this like the growing plane of the world would be indistinguishable, especially for fermions?
You can do it. I'm not an expert on this. And people have built these models.
Can we start from Dirac's
equation? Start from what?
Can we start from Dirac's equation and build this functions?
I haven't read those papers. But it's a field theory based approach.
Yes.
So you can cover all of standard physics in these models.
But in field, I think there is the concept of particles, like the trajectories.
Yeah. So then, in the field theory approach, well, there's actually when you look at the literature, there's various field theory approaches. The usual approach, which goes back to David Bohm, is that you take your there's a way of formulating quantum field theory where you treat the you have a wave function, you have a wave functional over field configurations. So you have a classical field configuration, you attach an amplitude to it using the wave functional. A different classical field configuration has a different amplitude attached to it. And so rather than having partial trajectories, you have these classical field configurations that play the same role. And then you can set up the de Broglie-Bohm model. David Bohm does this, you can take it over, you can take a Fourier analysis and separate it into its modes and so on. So you can, it's all the same physics. There's been some debate in the literature as to how you get particle-like events in this de Broglie-Bohm model there when you have fields. There's a lot of papers, and I haven't read all of those papers. There's another approach where people say, well, we want to treat quantum fields, but we're going to still have particles. And so people have built models where instead of using field configurations as the variables, they actually still have particles. I don't know how successful those approaches are, but that also exists in literature.
The criticism for it seems like
in this model, it's more related to classical probability theory than quantum probability theory.
This criticism?
Yeah.
In what?
In the sense that all the particles we know are going along, like are being carried by just one wave function,
mm-hmm.
and not the other. So,
yeah.
So it's either heads or tails. So
yeah.
If this philosophical problem is related to classical probability theory in that sense.
Yeah.
But in normal Copenhagen interpretation, it's going there and there simultaneously and
yeah.
do the measurement.
Yeah.
So
I think that's true that the Zipori-Bohm model uses a classical notion of problems. It doesn't have these problems with the probability that other people have. Yeah. But that's it.
So in that sense, this criticism is more problematic for the usual quantum theory than it is for this model.
I see.
But in Copenhagen, there's collapse, so you don't have this like these alternative stories where the wave function is really telling all these stories, but nothing is really happening, like zombie stories.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really have zombie stories in Copenhagen because they say that the wave function actually collapses.
Because there's no, I think, like, Copenhagen does not mention exactly about what is real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true, it doesn't say there's
so
an actual
actually,
collapse.
Like, there is no, there seems like no problems.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's, I mean, it's true that if you have collapse, and that the collapse models I'm going to talk about, that will be, after I've done many worlds, I'll talk about collapse models. If you have collapse, then you do collapse away these zombie worlds. There is a slight problem there, which I'll mention, which is that your collapse mathematically in these models it's not doesn't have compact support. It always has tails because you want it to be mathematically nice. So there are these tiny tails that have crazy stuff happening. People worry about that, but it's true. At least the idea of collapse is to get rid of the zombies. No longer. However, Copenhagen is not clear what its ontological commitments are. If you read papers on the Copenhagen interpretation books on that, then there's not a clear statement as to what the ontology is.
In my experience, so it's hard to assess these issues.
And that picture, when you talk about measurement in ordinary quantum theory, like wherever you measure, anytime, wave function will collapse on some part of the configuration space.
Yeah.
But here, there is an intermediate time that these trajectories, these like wave packets,
yeah.
hasn't been completely separated.
Yeah.
So it's kind of different. Like it doesn't give us the same result as the ordinary quantum theory at those intermediate times, right?
I think it would give you the same. I mean, if you plot this,
the example
I have,
it's not very good because they seem to be fairly separated anyway.
So those two wave packets just start on the zero axis and then separate out onto the
A
and B. Anytime you have, you could have a situation where the wave packets are more overlapping and they eventually separate out. And when they're more overlapping, you'll get lots of kind of crazy interference, you know, jiggling of the trajectories really move around because there's interference. You know, just like that, you have it here. Just like there, you have that jiggling where the wave packets overlap. You'll have that also
in that situation.
So then, like, if you work in Bohmian interpretation, like, we should say that I can measure my system at some time that I won't see this. My system wouldn't collapse on some part of configuration space. I can actually observe wave packets and all like in other places too. So like, I mean, it would give a different result from measurement with projection. So like,
I think
it's testable in some.
I think it. Okay, maybe I'm not understanding what you're saying. I think. In standard quantum theory, I don't think that's true, because it always reproduces the distribution of positions, which is a particular standard quantum theory. So I don't think it's going to do that. There is a strange phenomena which I could have mentioned, which if you get, which is to do with this interference of these different outcomes. So if you have a, so here I haven't put a mirror here. I haven't put a beam splitter, sorry, here on purpose. You can have a detector here. And this detector is some, so this is the X particle.
Okay.
I call this the X particle, the one that's traveling from here. And then you have a detector, which is the Y particle. And the detector could be then finally you have some ordinary detectors. So this detector could be consist of a particle which is initially in the ground state.
Okay.
So the Y wave function is just a ground state.
This potential.
Then if the particle goes along this path,
it just
keeps going and it excites this up to the first excited state. So that's an allowed unit
transformation.
And then so now either you're in the ground state or the first excited state.
So,
okay, is that, I'm just representing this schematically for the Y part. And then the two particles, this X particle comes here and here. And because there's no beam splitter, you know, our normal intuition is just that the particle either goes straight through here or straight through here. But it turns out that if this Y particle is at this location here, okay, then because of the no crossing principle, this particle that comes along here would have to bounce off here. Because the Y particle is just contributing the same amplitude for the velocity of this one. Of course, this is not completely obvious, but it's fairly simple. And this particle would go this way. So that means if you can have this detector would click
if it
comes along this way. And then later on, you can look and see what state this was in, and you could find it was in the excited state. You would find it was you would find it was in the ground state. No, I'm sorry, I'm not. Yeah, you'd find it was in the ground state. So what's happened there is the Y particle has gone this way. It's gone through this box, which looks like a detector. And actually, the detector, when you look at it, doesn't detect the particle.
It didn't click.
And so the De Broglie-Bohr model has things that, I mean, normally we'd think of this as a detector. It should detect the particle. But actually, it doesn't. The particle goes through it, but it stays in the ground state.
It's a strange thing that can happen.
And that's, when I modeled this, I said it was important that the two wave packets didn't overlap in position space.
And
that's a stronger constraint. If you don't do that, you get these effects. I'm not sure if this relates to the sort of thing you were talking about, because you're talking about where the point is intermediate. Okay. Right. So on Monday, many worlds.